Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. The financing of political campaigns in the United States is the subject of this July 21st, 2015 edition of Radio Curious. The topic is how the money primary is undermining voting rights. Our guest is Ari Berman, a contributing writer for The Nation magazine. Ari Berman asks, when the wealthiest Americans dominate every facet of political life, from who runs, to who wins, to which issues are addressed, to how our leaders govern, what happens to the voting rights of everyone else? The consequences of the United States Supreme Court's 2010 and 2014 decisions in Citizens United and in the case of McCutcheon versus the Federal Election Commission provide some insight into Ari Berman's question. When Ari Berman and I visited by phone from his office in Washington, D.C. on June 8, 2015, we began when I asked him to define the word wealth as it is used to deny the right to vote.
The concept of wealth in America is becoming more and more refined, or I should say more and more elite, because there are the wealthy. It used to be if you had $1 million, you were considered wealthy. And now, according to American politics, you're only really in the top 1% of the 1%, it seems, if you're an actual billionaire. And so there has always been a role of wealth in American politics. But what we're seeing is that, number one, the wealthy are becoming wealthier. There's a much greater concentration of wealth at the top and a disparity between those at the top and everyone else. And that's translating into what John Bonifaz and Jamie Raskin, two lawyers, dubbed in 1993 the wealth primary in American politics, basically saying that for candidates to be taken seriously, to be able to run for office, to be able to be elected to office, they have to get through what they call a wealth primary, meaning they have to have access to an extremely large amount of money and an extremely wealthy donor base to be successful, particularly on the presidential level. And this was something that they identified back in 1993 based on the 1992 election and preceding elections. And what I looked at in my last article was that this wealth primary that was described in the 1992 election has become astronomically worse in the post-Citizens United era, because if you look at the 1992 presidential election, it cost $331 million. And the 2012 race, the 2012 presidential race cost $2.6 billion. And the 2016 presidential race is going to cost billions more than that. And so the wealth primary has become much, much wealthier and much more predominant in American politics today.
Which de facto takes the right to vote, which has been declared to be a fundamental right by the Supreme Court, it takes it away from the average person.
What I'm arguing in this piece is that people still have a right to vote. They still have an ability to go and cast a ballot. But what I'm arguing is that the value of their vote is being diminished by the fact that the wealthier have such a disproportionate influence in the political process. No one can argue, I think, that someone giving $5 has the same influence as someone giving $5 million or $500 million, or in the case of the Koch brothers, $900 million. That money is buying influence, it's buying access, it's shaping the terms of the debate. And so what we're seeing now is when candidates, either at the presidential level or the congressional level, when they are preparing to run for office, the first question they're being asked is, how much money can you raise? And when they're running, what they're doing is they're spending 50% of their time raising money from the largest donors. And once they're elected, they're spending 50% of their time time raising money from the largest donors. And they're not spending time talking to people giving $5, raising money from people giving $5. And I think what we're seeing in terms of the policy preferences of these candidates and of these donors is that it's disproportionately benefiting the most elite Americans. We see, for example, if you look at opinion studies, that a large majority of Americans believe, for example, that the government should help anyone find a job who needs a job. But we're seeing that a very small percentage of the wealthy, less than 20%, agrees with that. So even though there's huge majorities among average Americans in terms of, you know, supporting policies like the minimum wage, like greater investment in public infrastructure, like, for example, government helping everyone find a job, that it's the wealthy Americans' political priorities that are being advantaged over everyone else. And that's why I think that there is still obviously a right to vote, but in terms of the value of the vote, that is what's being diminished.
So if we add that to the fact that 54% of the public and 17% of the wealthy, the larger group is in favor of raising taxes, the smaller group, the wealthy, are against it. So there's we take that into where the tax money comes from and where it goes.
Absolutely.
That not only affects the decaying infrastructure of our country, of the cities and education, but it creates a greater disparity.
Yeah, and so when people are asking themselves, why has inequality become worse in American society? We know, for example, that the gap between the rich and the poor is growing larger every day. The gap between the very rich and everyone else is growing every day. And the inequality in America has sharply increased from the 1960s and 1970s to the present. Why is that? Well, part of it is the economy, but part of it is also the political system, which is that the wealthiest Americans have been more and more able to translate their economic power into political power. And that's really what we're seeing in American politics today. And there's been some very interesting research on this. Political scientists, Martin Gillens from Princeton and Benjamin Page from Northwestern, did a very exhaustive study on the preferences of the wealthiest Americans versus the policy preferences of the rest of Americans. And they found that, quote, economic elites and organized groups representing business interests have substantial independent impacts on U.S. government policy, while average citizens and mass-based interest groups have little or no independent influence. And they concluded the majority does not rule, at least in the casual sense of actually determining policy outcomes. Now, what that means is that something is likely only going to become law if everyday Americans favor it and if the wealthy favor it. It's very, very rare that something happens when the vast majority of the 1% doesn't want it to happen.
The recent vote in Congress regarding the National Security Act and the ability of the NSA, the National Security Administration, to listen to conversations like this as we record them on the phone is an example of that.
I think what we're seeing is that there's a concentration of wealth and a concentration of power. And it's very difficult to challenge both of them. And I will say one thing, which is that, you know, we're seeing the wealth primary, I think, play out most dramatically on the Republican presidential side right now, because every Republican presidential candidate is searching for a billionaire to fund them. And if you look at the policy preferences of those billionaires, take, for example, Sheldon Adelson, who gave $90 million in the 2012 election. We've never seen any donor give, you know, $90 million to directly influence a presidential campaign and directly fund a candidate or multiple candidates. And Sheldon Adelson is very hawkish on Israel. He's very hawkish on national security. He is supportive of the war in Iraq. He very much wants there to be strikes on Iran. And so you look at those who are dissenting from that policy, someone, for example, like Rand Paul, who has criticized the national security state. Well, Rand Paul is being criticized by so many other Republicans, not just because that they disagree with him, but because all those other Republicans want Sheldon Adelson's money or those like him. They want the hawkish national security money that funds so many of the Republicans and also funds a number of Democrats as well. So this isn't just a story of a policy disagreement. It's also a story of the fact that the money is shaping so much of the policy disagreement.
Let's be specific on that policy disagreement between Rand Paul and the other Republicans with whom he disagrees.
We've seen that Rand Paul has criticized the National Security Agency. At one point in time, he was much more critical of Israel. He was much more critical of U.S. involvement in the Middle East and around the world, of foreign interventionism. I think we've seen him backtrack somewhat on this point. I think, you know, he at one point he said he wanted to cut off all foreign aid, and now he says he supports foreign aid to Israel, for example. And I think, you know, one of the reasons that he's going backwards a little bit on these policies is because he doesn't want to be totally cut off from the funding. Even if he can't raise money from the Sheldon Adelsons of the world, he doesn't want them to attack him head on. And so I think it's not just that candidates will take a policy position, it's that sometimes they refrain from taking a policy position because they're afraid of the money that will be spent against them. So I think that the money not only shapes policy outcomes, but it also has, I would say, a deterrent effect in candidates not wanting to take bold positions. So, for example, that's why you have, you know, Bernie Sanders saying that he wants to break up the biggest banks in America, but Hillary Clinton is not saying that because Bernie Sanders is not funded by the biggest banks, whereas Hillary Clinton is.
And similarly, on the Republican side, we're not going to see, as you say, the front runners acknowledging global warming.
No, I don't think we're going to see that because we see that they're getting so much money from the oil industry, from the coal industry, from the fracking industry. I mean, this is one of the major funders of the Republican Party. You look at the Koch brothers, which are the single largest funder now of conservative candidates. I mean, all their money was made in energy. And so you're talking about a situation where the Koch brothers have spent millions of dollars to try to discredit the idea, the scientifically proven idea that global warming is real. And so if you're a major Republican presidential candidate and you want some of that Koch brothers money, and believe me, they all want it, you're not going to take a policy position that you believe is in direct conflict with the Koch brothers' leading political interest. And so I think it's very hard to imagine a Republican frontrunner acknowledging that global warming is real or doing anything that would fundamentally criticize anything that the Koch brothers or Sheldon Adelson or all these large Republican donors are doing.
What do you think is behind the Koch brothers' position on global warming? By position, I mean their belief.
I think money is behind their belief. I think that they do have a libertarian view on regulation, that they don't believe in lots of regulation, but I think it's a self-interested view in regulation because they don't want the government to tell them that they're polluting too much and they need to change their business. And so I think so much of their money is being driven by self-interest, by wanting to preserve their business interests. They want to spend $900 million on the 2016 election. That's 10 times as much as Sheldon Adelson, the biggest donor, gave in 2012. So this is such an astronomically large amount of money that we're talking about here.
What is your vision as to how that money will affect the 2016 election?
Well, I think it will affect it in a number of different ways. I think the first thing that it's going to do is it's going to shape the positions that the Republican candidates for president take, because the Republican candidates for president aren't going to want to take any positions that are really at odds with the policy preferences of the Koch brothers. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that instead of Republican candidates trying to build a large, small donor base where they interact with more rank-and-file Americans, they're going to increasingly try to get as much money as possible from the wealthiest Americans, because they know that the Koch brothers and people like them are willing to spend this money, and so they're going to want to get a piece of it. And so how they decide to campaign for president is going to be geared towards that perspective. I think the third thing is that not just the Koch brothers' money, but all the institutions they fund, because they are already giving a tremendous amount of money to think tanks, to conservative media groups, to all sorts of institutions on the right, that they are going to try to create a consensus around issues that Republican candidates can and can't talk about. So we talked about global warming, for example, as one issue. And I mean, I think, you know, before the debates even begin on the Republican side of the aisle, and the first debate is August 6th, that the wealth primary is shaping the terms of that debate and what will and won't be discussed and what will and won't be prioritized. And then, I mean, the fourth thing is that, you know, whatever candidate, Republican candidate emerges, is just going to have a tremendous amount of money behind them, such a staggering amount of money, that will also influence what the Democratic presidential candidate does. Because the Democrats are looking at the amount of Republican money and they're saying, we need these billionaires too. And so Democrats, most likely Hillary Clinton, because she is the prohibitive frontrunner, she's going to have to tailor her campaign also to be able to compete financially with the Republicans. And that means that she's going to have to make a number of sacrifices as well. And so I think, you know, that $900 million that the Koch brothers are going to spend in 2016, I mean, that more than almost any other factor is shaping the 2016 race.
Ari Berman, if you were to characterize the issues that would be on the table that the presidential candidates would debate in 2016, what would they be?
I think if you look at the Republican debate, it's going to be about, you know, who's the most conservative candidate, who is the most anti-Obama candidate, who will represent the sharpest break from the policies of Obama, and also, you know, how is anyone going to differentiate themselves from the other candidates? And so I think the candidates are going to try to position themselves certainly on the right end of the spectrum, and it's going to be about, you know, bashing things they don't like the president has done, whether that is bashing Obamacare or bashing the executive action on immigration or criticizing any number of policies, blaming the president for the rise of ISIS when it comes to foreign policy. Now, the Democratic debate is very interesting because Americans, particularly Democratic primary voters, are extremely concerned about economic inequality and extremely concerned about the outsized role that Wall Street plays both in the economy and in the political process. And that's been one of the major themes of Bernie Sanders since he's announced his candidacy. Now, Hillary Clinton is someone who this puts in an interesting spot, because she is someone who is going to have to address the public's anger at Wall Street and the public's anger about economic inequality. At the same time, she is someone whose top donors are banks, whose top donors are Wall Street. Her largest donors when she was in the Senate were employees of Citigroup and Goldman Sachs. And so she's going to have to do a very difficult dance where she denounces income inequality, says she wants to do something about it, says she wants to rein in Wall Street, while at the same time raising money from the very people whose power she is claiming to want to diminish. And I think that's going to be very difficult tension for her, not just in the primary, but really throughout the entire campaign.
Let's shift our focus here for a minute and look at the historical perspective as to how the economics, the contributions from private monies, resulted in the Supreme Court decisions, particularly Citizens United, in relationship to the one person, one vote issue and the general right to vote that really came out in the mid-1960s. No poll tax, no filing fees, etc.
There's a few different issues here. One issue we've seen is that the Supreme Court has moved radically to the right over the years. Since there was a Warren Court in the 1960s, the difference between the Warren Court and the Roberts Court is so dramatic. And then the reason it's so dramatic is because we've had a series of Republican presidential candidates and Republican presidents, each more conservative than the previous one, who have been elected and have appointed those Supreme Court justices and have pushed it sharply to the right. And what we've seen is that, you know, you take George W. Bush, he once referred jokingly, although it was something of a Freudian slip, to the wealthiest Americans as his base. And he's appointed Supreme Court justices who have reflected that standard. And so it used to be, if you look at Supreme Court rulings in the 1960s, in Harper versus Virginia Board of Elections in 1966, the Supreme Court said that fee payments or wealth, like race, creed, or color, are unrelated to the citizen's ability to participate intelligently in the political process, basically saying that wealth couldn't be the basis of whether someone could vote. And then in 6 years later, in a case called Bullock versus Carter, they struck down filing fees in Texas that charged candidates up to almost $9,000 to put their name on the ballot. And they basically said that they would ignore reality if they didn't face the fact that the system basically disadvantaged those candidates who didn't have as much money. And so what we saw is, you know, in the 60s and 70s, a Supreme Court that was sensitive to the role that money played in diminishing the right to vote, the ability to run for office. What we see in the Citizens United decision is a very different perspective. The Roberts Court is far more concerned about regulation on money than they are about the impact of that money. And so they've taken a very, very narrow definition of corruption and a very expansive view of speech, basically saying that, you know, money is speech, and so money can only be regulated in very, very narrow cases where there's a quid pro quo corruption. So, you know, essentially you have a situation where, you know, a donor gives, you know, $3.5 million to a candidate, and the candidate does something illegal to directly benefit that donor. Short of that, there is no way to enforce corruption. And so I think we've moved very dramatically from a worry about the influence that wealth would play on the right to vote to a situation where the major concern of the Roberts Court is that this money not be regulated. And I think that's a very significant shift on the court in recent years.
I'd like you to comment, if you would, on the case that will be heard in next year's session of the United States Supreme Court, Evanwell versus Abbott, that will look at the question of one person, one vote. Does that depend on the number of voters in a district or the population of people in the district? That seems to be the focus of what the argument will be. Do you have thoughts on that?
Yeah, that does seem to be the focus of the argument. It was very surprising that the Supreme Court decided to take this case because it seemed to have been not only settled in the lower courts, but ever since the 1960s, one person, one vote wasn't really challenged. It's been the defining doctrine for over 50 years. And the idea was that, you know, one person, one vote meant one person broadly in terms of the broader population. So, you know, you looked at an area, you figured out what the population was, and you drew districts based on that. And that led to a lot more fairness. And if you drew districts simply based on who could vote, you're excluding a lot of people who otherwise would have representation. So you're excluding, for example, you're excluding children. You're excluding non-citizens who may be here legally, particularly in urban areas that are younger, more diverse, and have a larger immigrant population. And if you were to draw districts just based on voting age population and not total populations, what would happen is that districts in America would become older, wider, more rural, and more conservative, rather than younger, more diverse, more urban, and more liberal. It would also mean that potentially every district in the country would have to be redrawn, because right now they're being drawn based on total population, and so that would be a very dramatic change, perhaps the most dramatic change to redistricting since the one-person, one-vote doctrine.
Ari Berman, I want to thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious, and before we close, I'd like to ask some questions about you. First is, can you share with us a eureka or an aha moment that changed your life or your outlook toward the world?
My most dramatic eureka moment in terms of my political evolution was quite a long time ago when I was still in college. In 2002, I was studying abroad in Geneva, Switzerland, and I was studying the UN and all these international institutions. And this was after 9/11, and it was at the same time America was getting ready to go to war with Iraq. Here I was in Geneva listening to all these people talk about the good work they were doing, and I realized essentially that there were two places where power was exercised in the world. And one of them was in Washington, D.C., and the second was in New York, where the UN Security Council was. And so that really made me want to report on American politics, and I really had to go to New York or Washington to tell the story if I wanted to have any level of influence. And so that whole period really shaped, in a lot of ways, what I'm doing today.
And what would you like to do with the remainder of your one precious life?
Right now, I have a new book coming out in August about the history of voting rights since 1965 called Give Us the Ballot. But I would like to be able to continue to write about deeper substantive issues and try to focus on projects that really talk about the intersection of historical events and current events, and to try to offer a deeper lens on the headlines of the day.
Ari Berman, in addition to recommending your forthcoming book, Give Us the Ballot, are there other books that you could recommend to our listeners?
One book that I really loved and read a few times when I was researching my own book was John Lewis's memoir, Walking with the Wind. And he's a major character in my book and someone who's obviously a very noted civil rights figure. And then for fiction, I love Marilyn Robinson's book, Housekeeping. I think it's the best written book that I've ever read.
Ari Berman, thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious.
Thank you, Barry.
Ari Berman is a contributing writer to The Nation magazine who writes regularly on election and voting rights issues. How the Money Primary is Undermining Voting Rights is the title of his article in the May 19, 2015 edition of The Nation magazine. The books that Ari Berman recommends are Walking with the Wind, A Memoir of the Movement by Congressman John Lewis, and Housekeeping by Marilyn Robinson. This program was recorded on June 8, 2015. Radio Curious has over 500 archive editions on our website, radiocurious.org, with new programs published weekly. You may stream, download, subscribe to our podcast service, and share them as you wish. They're all free. We appreciate your thoughts, ideas, and comments about our programs and enjoy hearing from you. The email is curious@radiocurious.org. The phone is 707-462-6541. Christina Onnestad is the assistant producer. I'm host and producer, Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.